Good morning, and you are welcome to your Irish breakfast show, Song for Ireland. Frank Murphy here, bidding you a cild míle fáilte, which means 100,000 welcomes. Ah, sure, we were never given to exaggerations, the old Irish, and thank you for tuning in. Yes, and on this kind of humid Saturday morning, as you were driving in, I sort of saying to myself, wow, very close and heavy. But if you have time to spend in the scratcher and just rest and relax, you're in for a most stimulating show. Soon I'll be joined by special guest, Fremantle author Peter Burke, who will wind the clock back with me to March the 10th, 1902, and indeed further back to the near that south jetty in South Beach in Fremantle. And so, you know, we'll explore the how and the why and the what, and of course, Charles Yelverton O'Connor. I've mentioned it not frequently, but over the last couple of weeks in relation to what we're hoping to do. And yes, the hope is a dream. We will be there on March the 10th, and we're mud mapping is at the moment to find out how you essentially get to the spot where we will be, as close to the work by Tony Jones in the sea as possible for safety reasons. And all that is being worked out at the moment by myself and Dr. Ted Walker. But it's interesting nonetheless to go through what we will have. I'm certainly looking forward to meeting Peter Burke. In the meantime, Jerry Grogan, my producer, came up with the idea from last week and the week before of playing what was originally our sound theme, which was Mary Black doing Song for Ireland. But he said, oh, Frank, let's have a go at other people who sang the same song on record. And this is Damien Leith's choice. And Damien is hugely popular in Australia and indeed Bunbury and Perth and beyond with his rendition of Yes, Song for Ireland.
Walking all the day near tall towers where falcons build their nests. Silver-winged they fly, they know the call of freedom in their breasts. Soft black head against the sky with twisted rocks that run to the sea. Living on your western shore, saw summer sunsets, asked for more. I stood by your Atlantic sea, and I sang a song for Ireland. Drinking all the day in all pubs where fiddlers love to play. Someone touched the bowl, he played a reel, it seemed so fine and gay. Stood on Dingle Beach and cast in wild foam, we found Atlantic bass. Living on your western shore, saw summer sunsets, asked for more. Stood by your Atlantic sea, and I sang a song for Ireland. Dreaming in the night, I saw a land where no man had to fight. Walking in your dawn, I saw you crying in the morning light. Lying where the falcon flies,
twist and turn, all in your air blue sky. Living on your western shore, saw summer sunsets, ask for more. I stood by your Atlantic sea, and I sang a song for Ireland. I sang a song for Ireland.
Song for Ireland by Damien Leith. You're listening to Song for Ireland with Frank Murphy, presenting and hosting for you. Looking forward to meeting Peter Burke in after a few tracks, and we settle down with music. And sticking with Damien Leith for a moment, because I want to introduce you to Evelyn Williams, a wonderful woman from Talla, County Dublin, and what Talla has become, and her song Sending the Clowns. By way of contrast, I suppose we should dip into 1924 when Puccini wrote Turandot, and from Nessun Dorma, Pavarotti's done it. Up came Damien Leith and walked away with Australian Idol 2007. Let's go. And I send greetings to Fiona Mariah this morning. We'll be going out with Fiona much later on with Time to Say Goodbye. Welcome back, Fiona. Thinking of Damien Leith for a moment, I reckon that's a voice, a really good, good voice. And, you know, apart from studying pharmacy in Trinity College in Dublin, prior to coming here, he visited and worked in Players Theatre in Trinity, where he did some dramaturgy and drama. So there's training in acting there. And when I was in contact with him some time ago and recently about matters. There's a lot of exploration to be done in setting some of the poetry of John Boyle O'Reilly and some of the guys on board the Hougoumont to music. More of that and on. Now, going from Nessun dorme nella tua fredda stanza right back to Tala, and 2018 is but a hop, step and a jump, because Philip Barnett, our production manager, managed to rip the experience of Dublin's 82-year-old Evan Williams. I just had to let you share in the experience when she appeared in Ireland's Idol quite recently. And the amazing Louis Walsh starts to quiz her and asking her about her life, and you get the whole story here. I left the whole story in, not to just cut. She does the wonderful Sondheim, sending the clowns as her audition piece, and ultimately went on to perform it. And yes, she was still in there. And, you know, we've heard these singers originally in pubs with one, 98 Street in Cork, I remember. My cousin's husband, Dermot Lynch, brought me up to a wonderful pub in 98 Street. Years and thousands of years ago, went around the ones in Shandon Street with Jimmy Crowley, Shandon Bells, I think is the name of one. Brenda Neff would help me out here now, who's down the road and who knows all of these pubs in the north side. And indeed, they're in Dublin. I mean, for many, many years, they were sing songs in Dublin, and I'm sure Jerry remembers them in Kilrush in pubs. And, you know, they're sort of a thing that I don't see a lot of in Perth. You see, traditional music, as Rob Zielinski calls it, paddy music. I'm not sure I agree with that one, Rob. But you sometimes don't hear the people in the pub silencing to let one of the ordinary people in the pub sing a song. Sure, it's a tradition in Galway, all over parts of Ireland, and indeed County Clare. How could I forget the fiddle playing and the baron playing and the traditional music? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a classic song like Sending the Clowns and the story behind Evan Williams. Here goes the lot.
Oh my God, look at her shoes! Hello!
Good evening, everybody. Been a long day.
Tell us who you are.
I'm Evelyn Williams. Okay. I live in Tala.
How old are you?
I'll be 82 on the 29th of May.
Thank you for being a friend.
Hello, welcome to Ireland's Got Talent.
Thank you. I'm here today with my granddaughter Evelyn and my best friend Sue. I got married in 1961 and I had two children, a boy and a girl. And now I have six grandchildren and six great-grandchildren. I love the bones of them, of course I do. I love the bones of them. And they love Nana Chips. I forgot to tell you that today. They love Nana Chips and they love my cabbage. My cabbage. I don't know what way my daughter must cook the stuff. I think I'm telling you all too much. Like, my daughter's after being 9 years in Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
And my daughter's after ringing me now.
Wow, to wish you good luck.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know it's hard, isn't it?
Yeah. I miss them.
Of course you do, yeah.
Oh, God, my husband. I miss him like a limb. 7 years nearly now. He was a good man, you know. He was very good. He used to love to hear me sing. He was full of loving. He loved the kids. Yeah, I used to sing to them all. But so long as I do the best I can when I sing, I'll be happy. If I'm able to do it, that I'm satisfied that I've done it all right, that's okay. It's going to be a miracle. And I haven't been to Lourdes in a long time.
And Evelyn, why are you here today?
Well, I love singing. I've sung all my life.
Do you have a family? Are you married?
Oh, well married, Lou.
Yeah.
And I have six grandchildren and I have six great-grandchildren.
Oh. Wow.
And my first grandchild sings as well. She was instrumental in doing this. I was singing. Am I boring you?
No, not at all.
She needs her own show.
What are you going to sing?
Send in the Clowns.
Oh, it's my favourite song.
Sondheim.
Yeah. I'm living the life now tonight. Thank you. Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clowns. Isn't it bliss? Don't you approve? One who keeps tearing around, one who can't move. And where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours, and making my entrance again with my usual. I'm sure of my lines. No one is there. So don't you love farce? My fault, I fear. I thought that you'd want what I want. I'm sorry, my dear. And so send in the clouds. There ought to be clowns. Maybe next year. Isn't it bliss? And isn't it queer? I'm losing my timing this late in my career. So send in the clowns. You know, there ought to be clowns. Don't bother, they're
press the golden buzzer.
There is such life in this woman. She stood up here and commanded a stage better than anybody we've yet seen on this show. She's a storyteller.
Oh my God.
I'm not lucky enough to have my mother here with me on this journey. And then she stood here and she sang one of the most incredible Stephen Sondheim songs ever written, only meant to be sung by a woman this age who has lived a life.
Yeah.
And she sang it with love, and that just...
Thank you, Michelle.
judges, what are your comments?
You were incredible.
My mom and dad would be very proud of me.
Do you know who's proud of you now?
Who?
The whole of Ireland.
That's who loves you.
Oh my God.
You're great.
I hate going home now.
Angelis, you're 82 years young. You sang beautifully. And I honestly, you move me to tears because I just love everything about you. You're a lovely, lovely lady. And I'm so pleased, Michelle, for the Golden Buzzer.
I didn't even know what that was about, like, you know. I thought they're going to kill me in a minute. They're expecting me here with it.
She'll be signing autographs later.
I felt I could have sung better.
Ah, come on.
On my night. On my night.
You got the Golden Buzzer.
I know I got the buzzer. I am buzzed.
There is no other person that I would ever do that for. Do you know what? That was the right thing to do. She was amazing.
Don't you think?
Amazing.
She's 82.
Wait till she comes back. And she talks and talks and talks and talks.
And then another thing. And then the buzzer and another thing.
And with a mixture of lapping it all up and nervousness, she walks away with the honours. Enter the engineer, Charles Elverton O'Connor, but more important, enter Peter Burke, author. Well, Peter, did you notice the storyteller that woman was?
That was quite an outro, I thought.
Yeah, it was quite an outro.
I won't take any offence from being introduced with Send in the Clowns.
Not at all, because we're all here. Okay. And there's the final verse in the song actually says, well, maybe next year, you know, and she's... who made it her own by saying when don't bother, they're here, you know? Well, I found, and I'm finding Wetening Aurelia, the most fascinating book in the sense that we have our, you know, Tony Evans. Do you know Tony Evans passed away, by the way?
I heard, yes.
Yeah, Tony Evans just passed away. We have our Tony Evans, and we've had the Master, and we've had the Chief, sorry.
Yes.
And I can see you're just like me with your own copy of your own work, in that you have little flaps here and there.
Indeed.
But piece we want to talk about. But Peter, I mean, one of the, not the reviews, but in an interview you did, you were saying it's WA Foundation myth, I reckon, and a true tragedy of Shakespearean proportions.
Mm.
I've been like a magpie over 20 years collecting shiny bits of information, but let's go back to the WA Foundation myth.
Mm.
And we're up in the air on the, zooming in on the overview first.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, let's go into the foundation myth that you're claiming it was.
Well, I think that's what the tragedy of the C.Y. O'Connor death really was. But more broadly than that, I think the 1890s was the making of Western Australia.
Yeah.
The Western Australia that we think of now, with its sort of boom-bust, minerals-rich approach. And that wasn't the case. For the first 80 years of this colony, for the first 60 years, I should say, it bumbled along very poorly, and we watched, for instance, Melbourne, who was established after Perth,
yep,
have a boom, everything, and we almost closed down. We had the humiliating experience of having to become a convict colony, and then it all changed. And that period from particularly 1893 to... the awful close of the chapter when O'Connor died, not far from here, I think, was when Western Australia became Western Australia. The parallels to the recent past,
today,
I think, are striking.
Oh,
you know,
my goodness gracious.
We had, in 1893, people remember the depression of the 1920s, but there was a major worldwide depression in the 1890s, and we didn't have it. We had a boom. So during a global financial crisis,
yep,
we got gold, thanks to the Irish.
Yeah. And others, indeed.
And yep, really, Western Australia and South Africa were the richest places on planet Earth, and everyone came. All the fly-in, fly-out workers, they weren't flying back then, they were travelling by boat and wheelbarrow, but we had an incredible decade. John Forrest was the premier right the way through it, and C.Y. O'Connor was the engineer who, you know, as Forrest sent a telegram to him, said, we need everything. Saying ports, rail, the works.
This was to New Zealand at the time.
He was over there.
And
so I think it set up, you know, that pattern which we've seen many times since, where the rest of the world zigs and we zag.
Yeah.
And we've seen it recently. And then the downside of that is when the boom ends...
That's right, the bust.
There's often accusations about what we did with the boom.
Yeah.
And so the period we find ourselves in now is identical to that very difficult period, particularly 1901, 1902, when we saw the O'Connor tragedy.
Yeah, indeed. And a Shakespearean tragedy it is. But I want to move back from the epic tragedy. And as we say, they often say in making documentaries, don't kill the person off too early in that show, you know?
Right.
We certainly don't want to do that. But I notice your book, unlike other books, focuses on the man and his life in WA rather than, I mean, although it goes back a little bit, it's not like the Tony Evans book where...
I don't have the discipline for that. My mind wanders, and I am magpie-like. I love collecting facts, so I end up with huge numbers of them. And, you know, I've got the freedom as a writer, essentially of historical fiction, to bung in whatever I like.
So, and that is a unique gift. Because you can manage to... I don't know what words in your mouth, but the way you manage to put flesh on the bones, even the... I'm going to take the simple... I can't say the stable... The guy who was looking after the horses. What was his name for C.Y.?
I've forgotten his name.
You did a whole chapter to him here. We'll get it in a minute. But to me, the way you describe, he's watching C.Y. O'Connor from the window, do you remember?
Yes.
And he is mentioned in the Tony Evans book as well. But yes. It's just the way you do that, the way you do his the portrait of the daughter working in the Fremantle Hospital, and the way you do Forrest and Vosper and the different... They're each given a chapter, and indeed you begin... by writing in the first person. Pray explain, Peter.
Well, I wanted to get into the head of these characters. So, look, I have enormous respect. You know, Tony Evans' book on O'Connor is fantastic. Mirab Torman's book prior to it was fantastic, and Geoffrey Bolton wrote.
But
you need enormous amount of discipline to do that. I think sometimes West Australian history is presumed to be boring, and my interest is in unboring it, making it interesting. And I think the thing for non-academic historians that makes history interesting is the humans. You want to know what the hell was going on. And so I, you know, obviously using poetic license, get into the head of all the main players, all of which are pretty well-known names. So I get into the head of Kate O'Connor, O'Connor's feisty daughter. I get into the head of Paddy Hannon and imagine his conflicted view of what happened to Kalgoorlie. He was a loner, and I have him thinking about what the consequences are for the Aboriginal folk who have now got this storm of avaricious white men storming over their territory. Now, I don't know what Paddy Hannon thought. Nobody did, even at the time. Journalists interview him and he wouldn't say anything.
Come up, yeah.
But that is a great blank canvas for a writer.
Yeah.
So it's not meant to be, of course, factual. Who could know these things? You don't really know what your best friend's thinking. But it's very much based. To do that, you really do need to know an awful lot about each of the characters, and that's the bit that interests me. So I write each chapter from a point of view of a particular person in history, and a couple of made up ones.
but the way you dance between these, I hate the word faction, but I mean the way you dance between facts and putting the nightgown on is Vosper, one of the people, in late at night, and the way you kind of embellish the facts, I really love it. I mean, but it's an intense read. I mean, I haven't yet got through it. I mean, I've flipped through it over the the last couple of days, but I haven't yet got through it because it does take some focus to actually get in to the way you've done these characters in a wonderful, colourful and interesting way. You know, the nightmare of Vosper the night before when he's not that the infamous Tommy when he's thinking how is he going to write and what's he going to write, and you can hear the guys doing the clacking of the compositors ready, and he's purposely delaying strategically so that they'll get over double time, and the actual, you know, toadsters and whatever is in his mind, and he pulls down some of the stuff he previously wrote in the Caligari, whatever, and sort of thinks this is where I'll begin, you know, all that stuff is, you know, Peter, very early on in this conversation I'm going to say to you, it's the stuff that films are made of. Has that occurred to you at all? That you've actually written a treatment for a film?
Well, look, the whole story is very filmic, isn't it?
It is, it is.
And anyone who stood on that beach down there in front of that beautiful monument in the water.
Tony Jones, yeah.
Indeed, which you know, you'll be standing out in front of there on the 10th of March. Anyone has done that, and I've done the swim with the family there once. And
Would you describe it to me?
It's incredibly moving. I mean, you can't help. Look, I think anyone, particularly if you're a generational West Australian, there is an amazing legacy of guilt, collective guilt, about what happened to a good, honest, competent man. And we all felt a bit guilty, and even though, of course, none of us here were there at the time, there's that connection that echoes through the ages because the principles are much the same. I mean, I feel, you know, even when we hear recriminations about children's hospitals and big ovals and that sort of stuff, you hear a similar sentiment and a similar readiness to attack people that have to do really difficult jobs.
Oh, yeah.
And poor old O'Connor, the more you get into the story, the more you realise that he was just left friendless. And, you know, everyone who paid threepence for that Sunday Times, which wrote that awful article 1 month before, must have, later on, their heart must have sunk.
Yeah, so I mean, I see the parallels. My mind is going through the lower house at the moment, and the gallery of people in the front row, whatever are the circumstances surrounding you know who Barnaby, you know, there is still, I mean, it's a media feast, you know, to get in there. I'm not coming down on one side or the other now because it's a very, but I mean, is it as simplistic though to parallel that with O'Connor? I mean, you see, Mike Lefroy sat where you sat a couple of weeks ago, and he was very sensible about it, and he said, Frank, what you must understand is, and I'm beginning to understand, that each person is their own personal custodian of history. And if anybody disagrees with them, they're quick to jump in and defend the sometimes indefensible. Now, I'm paraphrasing him now, but would you agree with me?
Well, look, the angle I came to this one from was starting with that terrible article which appeared 1 month before. And that's the article in the Sunday Times on the 9th of February 1902.
Have a read.
And that was the one that it had a huge headline that said, Corruption by Contract.
Yep.
Chummy Couston and O'Connor, the pipe track scandal. Toadies and tricksters who should be tried. And the language through the whole article is outrageous. You know, nowadays you'd be taken to court for libel, and in retrospect, every single word that was printed was false. O'Connor was a crocodile imposter, guilty of reckless, extravagant juggling of public funds. He'd robbed the taxpayer of this state of many millions of money. Incidentally, £2.5 million was the quote, slightly less than that, on time and under budget. Not a cent wasted. The proposed contract with Couston was a swindle, and it was an open rumour everywhere that this shire engineer from New Zealand had absolutely flourished on palm grease since the first day. And if he was not immensely rich, there is a mystery somewhere. Well, the only mystery, as it turned out, was that he had £200 to his name. So there was, and it was subsequently shown that there was absolutely none of those things were true. So I became very interested in particular, I noticed as I read Evan's book and also Tormund's book, I noticed that no historian would name the author of that article, or if they did, they named the wrong fella.
Yeah, Vosper.
They all named Vosper.
Yeah.
Now, I'll put my hand up as being an enormous fan of Frederick Charles Burleigh Vosper.
Amazing men. Looks like the what's the amazing guy who was with the Nicholas II with the beard and
oh,
all
Rasputin.
Yeah, yes, I kind of find him kind of a likable Rasputin-esque type person. Yeah.
Well, he was a thoroughly get elected to Parliament in a flash today, particularly in Fremantle.
Yeah,
because he was
the long hair.
He was a social activist, lefty, and. He had long hair. You know, he'd been to prison for supporting the miners in a strike over in Queensland. They shaved his head, and he said, "That's the last time I ever cut my hair." So he had hair down to the middle of his back, a striking angular and incredibly articulate fellow. And his heart was in the right place. You know, he was for women's rights. He was for... He was a bit of a racist.
he certainly was. Yeah,
there's a bit of yin and yang and everything, but mental health. He was a big proponent of improving conditions at the Fremantle Asylum. Unfortunately, he was given to radical solutions, and so his solution was to demolish the place, which I'm glad I'm sure the Fremantle Arts Centre is very happy it didn't take place, because it's a beautiful building.
Well, I know the place well, yeah. And there's still the remains of the lunatic asylum, as they call it, so-called, quote-unquote, isn't there a museum there to all the legacy of the work?
Indeed.
So, and you go back to Vosper, though. Yep. I mean, Jack of the Lad give me the opinion among middle-class Western Australia at the time, because that was because O'Connor, of course, moved in the circles of middle-class STEM, which was, in a way, was like, very dangerous.
Not only. I don't think that's completely fair. He would have walked down the port there, and every worker would have said g'day to the chief. I think he strode both sides very well. It didn't stop him getting attacked from right and left and middle when it came to it.
No,
but Vosper was very clearly on the left, and you know he was, because I mean West Australia suddenly was in two halves: metropolitan and the goldfields. And the goldfields population became greater than Perth. I mean, it was huge, and he was pro the alluvialists. The alluvialists were the small man who could just pick up or dig down to 10 feet. And then, the big guys were the guys who ended up taking over Kalgoorlie, who were big, big companies. So he was for the small man, and unashamedly so, ran the newspaper there. And when he came back to Perth, he was always unashamedly on the side of the underdog. If there was a problem, at his funeral, to which O'Connor sent flowers, and to which Sir John Forrest sent flowers, incidentally...
1901,
That's right. I've preempted the fact that Vosper could not have written that article in 1902 because he died of appendicitis on the 6th of January 1901.
Ruptured appendix,
So off he went. And, in Bolton's book, he sort of implied that he would have been destined for high office. He, may have even been a potential replacement, and a much better one, for John Forrest when he left... the next week.
For federal parliament.
So he modifies his views a bit. He wasn't as strident as he settled into Perth, but he was a thoroughly good fellow, and I would have loved to have met him. He's my favourite West Australian of all time.
Oh, wow, that's big.
It is big because he's been maligned by historians for as being responsible for that terrible article, and he'd been dead for a year, so it's a pretty good alibi.
Peter Burke is my guest, special guest on Song for Ireland this morning. We're going to go to a track on C.Y. O'Connor soon, Peter. Just want to ask you this, and I don't mean to ask you to retract that thing about C.Y. O'Connor. What I was trying to communicate to you, albeit incorrectly, was the sort of, not the middle class values as much as the stiff upper lip thing where, you know, his courtesy, talking to the ordinary man in the street, talking to the guy, going, his daughter would always say, why did you give sixpence to that person? Why did you give this to that person? Well, I mean, the courtesy was there, but there was also a sort of, what I'm gleaming from both your wonderful book and from Tony Evans and all along the way, was that because he was striding in a horse and because he had the outer trappings of success, really. And so people would not kowtow, but respect sincerely, or not, but I'm sure, the fact that this man was, acclaimed and acknowledged as a man who was in a wealthier house in Fremantle. And that's where I'm coming from, you know. The fact he didn't show what was going on in the head, and we'll come to that down along the way, if you don't mind. Look, three groups have recorded songs. We will have Bernard Carney with us on the Outside Broadcast. I hope you can be there, by the way.
I'd love to.
Yeah, and Bernard Carney, we're first of all coming with the Gang of Three, and Alan Ferguson wrote a song about C.Y. O'Connor over 20 years ago. So let's go with song number one. My special guest, Peter Burke, author of Wetterning Aurelia. What an amazing read. As you must attend the Outside Broadcast on the 10th of March, you must also go and buy Wetterning Aurelia.
Why, O'Connor, why have you come to this land? See, why, O'Connor, building pipe over rock and sand? See, why, O'Connor, you stand on our sacred land. See why, O'Connor, building pipe over rock and sand. The water will serve two peoples. Yours and mine will be as one. And the gold that we take from this red earth will make you rich, each woman, man, and son. See, why, O'Connor, why have you come to this land? See, why, over rock and sand. See why, O'Connor, you stand on a sacred land. See why, O'Connor, building pipe over rock and sand. A future for 100 years, and the gold that you steal from our red earth leave only sadness, death, and tears. Why, O'Connor, you stand on
our sacred land. See why O'Connor building pine over rock and sand.
And my special guest, author of the extraordinary new book on C.Y. O'Connor. Let's just clarify for a moment, Peter Burke. Wetting Aurelia. Let's clarify and be really sure of Aurelia and what the significance of that, rather than Western Australia, yeah?
Yes, so it's a... no one ever pronounces it correctly, and that's because I'm an annoying person, but look, it's partly an elaborate pun, so I can have in gold letters on the front the letters WA. So that's a sort of a visual allegory.
I like that.
Look, what is Aurelia? Aurelia was a breakaway state. You know, Western Australia suddenly had money.
Right.
The rest of Australia did not, and we're coming up to Federation.
Yep.
Now, if you'd asked West Australia 10 years earlier, did they want to join Federation, they would have been in a second, because we were lagging behind, and anything that would pull us out of our out of our drudgery, we would have been into. But suddenly we realised we've got all this dosh, and they're just going to take it from us. It didn't end up happening, obviously. he says ironically, because obviously all our GST goes that way. So you can understand. You know, we didn't want to go. Suddenly, but the eastern, you know, our gold fields, the eastern gold fields. Were mostly t'other siders, and they did want to go because mostly they were going to head back home anyway.
Yeah.
And so we had this breakaway thing. So the people of Kalgoorlie and Albany joined in and Esperance joined in. They were saying, you know, we want to join Federation. Forrest was sitting on his hands and didn't want to join. So the Chamberlain, that's not Neville Chamberlain, he wasn't around yet, but Joseph well, he was around, but this is Joseph Chamberlain.
You have a chapter to him in the book.
I do. He was petitioned by the people of Aurelia, which was going to be the breakaway state with its capital at Kalgoorlie, land of gold, Aurelia.
Oh, wow.
So Australia without the ST, and the port would have been Albany, and almost everyone signed, or half the population signed, saying they wanted to be the state, if Western
Albany
Australia
being the deep sea port at the time.
Indeed, they were annoyed because O'Connor had built this stupid port in Fremantle and was taking all the P&O traffic.
Well, so of course
that
he was.
He wasn't that popular down there because they'd had the port.
And he had the vision. Sorry about that, Albany.
Yes, bad luck. But look, so it very nearly happened, and Western Australia would have been left resourceless. Well, later on we would have discovered other stuff, but it would have been terrible. So Forrest really had his arm twisted by Chamberlain saying, listen, you've got to get in. But if you read, you know, and so we joined Federation, but we only joined belatedly. If you read the Constitution of Western Australia, of Australia, it starts with the words, given that the people, well, the colonies of New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria, Tasmania, South Australia and New Zealand have indicated that they'd like to form a federation, ... West Australia ain't mentioned. And we're obviously retrofitted, but we didn't want to join in. So Aurelia, and so there we have Wetting Aurelia, that's O'Connor getting the water to the very dry. We would have had that up our sleeve. Because once we hit the pipeline, hope you're enjoying the water, hope the gardens are nice, and then we could have just turned it off.
Yeah,
that would have upset Aurelia.
All right. So we have to at this stage allow somebody to come on stage, namely the amazing Tommy Walker. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So let's describe. You've kind of given us a pen picture of a little bit of Osprey. We'll come back to him again, but now I think it's time to give Tommy. Now, what an extraordinary! I mean, Peter. I mean, in not even using my notes, just looking at the hard copy or working out of it from memory over the last 2 intense days of reading. I mean, we're getting a mixture of somebody who was a stage performer, capable of putting people into some sort of
trance.
Trance, yes, exactly. Yes. Working his magic on them, and yet, how are you stepping back now from the Toad writer?
Mm.
How do you reckon? I mean, give us a picture of enter Tommy Walker, and off you go.
Well, Tommy Walker is the villain of my piece.
Okay,
he's never been mentioned, to my knowledge, by a historian in connection with the article that contributed to O'Connor's demise. He is, however, mentioned in this book here, All I May Tell, by Victor Courtney, who owned the Sunday Times and sold it to an upstart South Australian.
I must say, listener, I just want to share with you. Sorry, Peter. He's got some incredible first editions in front of me here, which must be worth thousands of bucks. Anyway, go on, Peter. As you were saying, enter Tommy Walker.
So journalists have mentioned that this was your man that wrote the article, and he himself admitted in libel cases in the Supreme Court that he was the editor of the Sunday Times. When Vosper was editor of the Sunday Times, his name was blazoned across the top, and everyone knew that the opinion in that paper was F.C.B. Vosper's.
Yep.
On the day he died, it went anonymous, and it went much, much nastier. Bolton described the editors. He didn't name them, but he said he referred to a brilliant description of the guy who I'm about to describe, Tommy Walker. And he described, without naming him, an individual given to broadcasting invective at random.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a beautiful description of this fella. He was a very vituperative, bad person to know.
Yeah.
And he came to West Australia with already a very long history, including...
Lancashire-born, was he? English? Yeah.
How about I do this? This is from the book, and it says this. To say that Tommy Walker came to the job with a colourful curriculum vitae would be to greatly underestimate the matter. Originally from Preston, Lancashire, in the industrial heartland of northern England, Tommy had worked at various times and in various places as a mesmerist's assistant, a spiritualist, and later an exposer of the fraudulent practices of spiritualists, a farmhand and a pharmacist, an assistant lecturer in atheism, a secularist proponent of commercial trading on the Sabbath, a populist campaigner against the mobilisation of the Sudan contingent, and an anti-royalist who demanded that all the funds raised for Queen Victoria's Jubilee be donated to the poor. An advocate of birth control with a conviction for exhibiting lewd pictures in the promotion thereof, an unsuccessful campaigner to save a convicted bushranger from the noose, an Australian bush poet with two published volumes, a playwright and an actor, playing the blackamoor in his own play at Sydney's Theatre Royal to muted reviews, the honourable member for the North Coast seat of Northumberland in the New South Wales Legislative Assembly, a champion for easier divorce and for reform of the legal profession, a temperance worker, and a teacher of elocution to New Zealanders.
Very sus. Very sus.
So that was some of his history.
And so Tommy had been talking forever at the age of 10. He was a prodigy of gospel preaching at the age of 13. Can I ask you, the research, now, how much is fact here and how much is...
Every word of that is true.
Research
fact. He has an amazing... And it gets better. So he was a man of opposites, okay? He was an early religious, one of those... prodigy preachers who became a rampant secularist.
One
time, while he was a parliamentarian on a train in Sydney, travelling to Redfern, and he'd had a few shandies, a vicar got on the plane on the train, and he said to his mate, "Here's another one." He sits in the seat in front of him, and Tommy shot him through the back of the seat.
That's right.
So he shot a vicar.
Wow.
And he would frequently attack, you know, a month before O'Connor copped it, an Anglican vicar in Mount Lawley was accused of, the Bella Heckler case, he was accused of getting his maid pregnant and then hiding it by getting a doctor to spuriously declare her insane and putting her in the Fremantle Asylum. None of which was true, but he was, you know, so he was an alcoholic who became a temperance worker, and he was a staunch Republican, who, you know, when he finally achieved high office, which we'll come to in West Australian Parliament, enjoyed wearing the wig and the mace and doing the whole thing. So he was a man of internal contradictions.
But he didn't like Peter. I'm speaking up to Peter Burke, the amazing author of Wetting Aurelia. How true is it about the burns and the phosphorus and the fact that he didn't want people up close? So the wig and the thing did a lot of concealment of what was a bit of the past, which he was able to conceal and hide behind all the time. I'll describe that for the listener.
Well, it's documented in the Toronto newspapers. When he was 16 years old, he claiming to be a spiritualist in a hotel room, he hid in a cupboard. And he had to use a bit of phosphorus to give him a sort of an ethereal glow sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was new at it, and he caught fire. And so the client, it was a guy by the name of John Saunders, noticed the cupboard was sort of glowing in an unearthly manner and opened the door to find Tommy Walker, you know, the later Attorney General of Western Australia, on fire. And so he pulled him out, tried to put him out with a blanket, and caught fire himself, and caught fire badly, and Tommy disappeared, and with his father took an ocean liner a couple of nights later back to England. Saunders died 3 days later.
From the burns?
From the burns, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how did the Walker, survive them? In the thing? His arms were burnt and parts of his face were something.
Yeah, no. Well, he wasn't too bad. I don't think that was the cause of his unpleasant visage.
Okay, all right. Yeah. What do you describe his visage as? I just gave it there as, with a very penciled it in, painted for me.
Scary would be my main adjective. Okay. He's obviously...
But describe him physically. He walks through the door here. Mm. Enter stage right, Tommy Walker.
He definitely have a... there's a picture of him when he became the Attorney General. And he was an intimidating, angular, bespectacled. But there's something, he has an odd sardonic smile. And when I describe... In the photograph there, I say Tommy Walker outside Parliament House, possibly smiling.
yeah. With the monster cigar in his mouth. Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so bring that to its, I can't say conclusion. So, Tommy Walker, you claim, wrote The Unforgivable and The Unforgettable. Yeah.
So he was taken to court over the Bella Heckler articles by the vicar, and was forced to admit in the Supreme Court that he was the editor at that time. So those, you know, just in the month prior to the terrible O'Connor article, he had brought down a premier, and he had written these terrible articles about the vicar, and each of these were really, really horrible articles. But he was. It provides some documentary evidence because it means he was forced later to admit that he was the editor. They didn't use bylines and there were no names, but there seems little doubt. But I'd love to have that have someone attempt to provide a counter argument.
Yeah,
There were two other editors there, but they just could not be candidates for reasons that I've sort of elaborated on in there. So he.
Was he compelled to do it, or should I say, did he offer to do it? I mean, or did he want to do it? All those three things.
He demonstrated a similar inclination from age 16.
Bring him down.
I think there wasn't many principles involved, in Tommy Walker's career that I can see. He flips and flops. The one principle which is always there is the furtherment of Tommy Walker. And he did, you know, he benefited enormously from his time at the Sunday Times. Within a couple of years of this article, he was the Labor MLA for Canowna, which is now a ghost town past Kalgoorlie. And about then he decided he'd also study for the law. And so he studied for the law at nights and was a parliamentarian by day, famous for talking an awful lot in Parliament. And on the day that he was admitted to the bar, He walked from the Supreme Court to Parliament House, and 1 hour after being admitted to the bar, was made the Attorney General of Western Australia.
Oh, man.
So the shortest, most meteoric legal career in
Western
Australia.
Metaphorical and our physical jump, leap forward, pretty, quantum leap.
Pretty good career move, yes.
So, yeah. So then let's speculate, or you bring not the evidence in, my lord, you bring your thoughts on how aware was C.Y. O'Connor of that person being around and capable of doing it. I mean, O'Connor is a very intelligent man. Mm. So was Tommy Walker, you have to help me here because as I sped read through the book, was Tommy Walker well known? I mean, you have doggerel verse there written by him. I mean, how aware would you reckon C.Y. would have been of him and his reputation?
It's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
He was certainly aware of what he wrote because there's at the inquest, one of the engineers, one of the steelmakers who spent time with O'Connor in the weeks prior, was there when he and describes how distressed he was at that particular article. So we know that the nature of the article greatly distressed him. And Kate O'Connor always said that she thought that the Sunday Times had killed her father. There was more to it than that. Parliament was attacking him as well, of course. The VOSPA had a very high profile. So most people still, probably even in Perth, possibly people still thought of it as VOSPA's Sunday Times. It was just one of those things where VOSPA became a section of the Sunday Times.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was sort of convenient for historians early on just to continue to mention VOSPA because
his name was in the mix.
And, so I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that people didn't mention his name other than in a hushed manner, particularly once he became the Attorney General, not even his journalistic colleagues. So one of the colleagues who was on the newspaper with him in Kalgoorlie wrote a slightly teasing article in his a little magazine called The Signet, which I've never seen. I'd love to see. Apparently it was a beautiful artistic little thing, and he put a little gently teasing article about how, as Attorney General, he'd hidden the volumes of New South Wales Hansard that referred to the awkward thing to do with him with the cupboard and the phosphorus and the Toronto business. He didn't want anyone knowing about that. And also, I think, because Henry Parkes hated him, he'd also mentioned the shooting the vicar.
Yeah.
So he'd hidden them. And it was gently straight away, the Attorney General, who prior to becoming Attorney General had been all iconoclastic, brought down a KC upon this journalist, had the newspaper shut down, and we learned then, and every journalist would have learned, maybe you don't mention Tommy's name in a bad way. And I reckon everyone just got in the habit of just expurgating him from history. I can see no other reason for it. We had the name VOSPA associated with the Sunday Times, and anything you read now, even if you go up to Mundaring Weir and get the leaflets there, it'll always mention VOSPA.
VOSPA
is your bad guy.
And Forrest. And tell me, how did you come upon him?
Well, once I started looking, he just popped out of every book I opened. Obviously, he's mentioned in Courtney's book. He had the Sunday Times for years. I was just, to distract myself, I was reading some Henry Lawson, and then there's a little thing.
There's a connection there because Henry Lawson's mother,
absolutely. And Henry Lawson talking about why he took up writing, and there's Tommy Walker's name falls out. He says he stood in front of the post office in Sydney and heard Tommy Walker talk and realised then that he had to write or bust. And that's Henry Lawson. He was a very prominent name and just one of those.
Orator, talker, all those things.
Agitator.
Agitator.
Yeah.
So is there any of the doggerel verses that you'd like to read, or shall I attempt them, or a piece of them? I mean, I remember that in your book when you were mentioning which one of the daughters of O'Connor, was it the nurse?
Well, Kate in particular.
Kate.
The book, I have her as a friend of a nurse.
As a friend of a nurse,
Kate, of course, became an artist.
I know the wonderful Kathleen. Kathleen O'Connor.
But she was a very strongly individual woman called a spade a a shovel.
Yep. Okay, well, do you want to read a bit of shovel then? Or is it in the book?
Well, there's a little bit of verse.
A little bit of verse.
Well, see, he wrote this, you know, Bush Pilgrims and Other Poems, and, you know, they're all, you know, lilting, generous, about how we're all part of one brotherhood of man, and how a little kindness would do beautifully. But you have a much more beautiful reading voice than I do, Frank. So have you got
Well, I'm just looking at the bit of by Vosper at the end. But I mean, by Vosper at the end. But I mean, I have it. Yeah, it says the new woman. It seems.
That was Vosper.
That was Vosper as well. Yeah, yeah. So I can't find a piece by. Let's give it a tiny bit. Let's just check it out here and see. We just opening the book and see it's a beautiful called Look, Irish Bush Pilgrims, and I'm just going to open the book. The Prince. Nay, weep not, chosen of my love. My heart is still as true to thee as is the mirror of the sky in yonder powerful lake. My heart rejoices in his present flight upon the wings of love forbid, as birds escaping from their cage sing sweeter to enchant the wind, champions to their liberty. And she responds, 'Tis like the bending of the sun to kiss a meteor, or like the sea. And you, a dewdrop, vowing love, what can a peasant maiden hope more than to win a peasant's hand? Shame even now cast over me, her painful alternating shades that send the hot blood to my face and icy currents to my heart, that I should even talk to thee so high above my lowly lot than to shine to thine eyes I can ever see. Well, it's just, you know, it's like Gilbert and Sullivan, you know?
And I can attest, listeners, that Frank had never, he just opened that book to that page, never having seen it before, and that's amazing that you can just put that emphasis on. But look, the thing about Tommy, you know, he could write like that, but the word hypocrisy comes to mind, because, you know.
Absolutely.
What he would write in newspapers was so, it was not like Vosper. Vosper was humorous, and to a cause, he just used to broadcast invective at random, in the words of Geoffrey Bolton.
Yeah. So that was the equivalent of social media today. Mm. I mean, the newspaper, yeah? Mm. You know, when you just think of the power of the West Australian and the Sunday Times, there was all the news was emanating from those two sources in the absence of radio or the little wireless, you know? Yes, yes. I mean, 1902, 1903, people were, you know, ready with their threepence on a Sunday and ready with their tuppence on every single day to get the West End.
It's slightly reassuring to realise that people were just as bad back then. You know, sometimes we like to think that social media is a new thing. Maybe it wasn't as disseminated as quickly, but I can tell you, when you read the stuff, the journalism in West Australia in the 1890s was really vicious, you know. And Kalgoorlie in particular, the Goldfields journalism was it's actually brilliant to read, but it's libelous, most of it.
Where are you going next? Because I've got a specific question to ask you, Peter. Do you want to go somewhere with this?
I wanted to just, you know, I thought by contrast of that,
yes,
just a little quote from the Sunday Times of the 16th of, I've got February, that can't be right, 16th of March, 1902. There's a typo in this book. I'll blame the editor. So this is 16th of March. We know the significance of that. This is after the funeral of O'Connor.
Yeah.
And there was a little contretemps over the grave
between
an unwanted journalist.
That's right. Yeah.
One of the pipe makers, and he says, so he's now justifying why he wrote all this stuff, for the public good, and he's very strong to stress that it's the public good, and he says, you know, with all respect and sympathy. No honourable, strong-minded man is afraid even of the severest public criticism. It is only men of weak intellect or men who feel and realise some oppressive guilt upon their consciences who are perturbed by questions upon their conduct. So is even post-mortem attacking O'Connor's integrity.
Yeah.
And then defending himself, he writes, "The irreverent accusation that criticism drove the deceased to self-destruction is the cruel imputation, therefore, that he was utterly unfit for his public position." The cruelty, of course, consists in its coming in such cowardly form on such a solemn occasion, the funeral, from the professed friends of the dead. Now, to me, this article is the worst that ever came, because knowing the consequences,
mm-hmm.
this man is still prepared to stand in his corner
yeah.
and attack those bereaved friends and the deceased.
Well, well, I want to go to a track, but I'm not going to. Before I do, I'm going to go to the Johnny McAvoy. Before we do lead on to further, we will go to Johnny McAvoy. "I Wish I Was Young Again, Home in My Heart Again, If Wishes Were Fishes." Tell me about C.Y. O'Connor's. We'll come back to this, and we're doing well. We're doing well. It's tipping after 9:10. You're listening to Song for Ireland. My special guest is Peter Burke, "Wetting Aurelia," an amazing book. In the West, we all know this story, sort of, he says in that wonderful cover. And the shot in the opening cover is of the 1903 opening of a pouring of the water, which has been mythologized hugely in schools and by kids. But we've got, you asked me not to highlight this, but I will. You're a medical doctor, okay? So in the sense, I mean, Tony Evans talks about the fact that he had C.Y. O'Connor at the time of his death, owing to stress and owing to, you know, lots of stuff to deal with, drank heavily. And so he says, and there was also a heavy cirrhosis of the liver. Whereas you don't say that. You said there's a light cirrhosis. I mean, I'm not being, I mean, would you have regarded it as C.Y. O'Connor, from all that you've gleaned and all of those years of research, that he was knocking back the old brandy to steady himself down and went through several meltdowns and so on and so forth?
Well, look, a bit. I would have thought if you did a post-mortem on most people in the about the turn of that century, most probably would have had a bit of cirrhosis, to be honest.
I don't think,
you know, in a gentleman of his age.
A
bit of brandy and you know, look, he had an incredibly stressful job. And I think he was the sort of fellow that, if you compared him to John Forrest, you know, John Forrest, I think, was a much more resilient fellow. He had more sense of humour. Was used to the barbs. And
the cousin thrust.
I think so. Came from a big family of boys. He probably, you know, all that stuff that happens. Margaret, his wife, they had no kids. Very strong relationship, very happy relationship. They went to Melbourne and everyone wanted to be, you know, what they call the dinner party, which is to go to Margaret and John's place. I don't think things... I think he was a more tense man. I think he was a man who took his reputation very seriously and was more seriously wounded when public comments were made, particularly unjustified ones. But look, you know, with these things, there's always so many factors there. But I wouldn't put too big a thing on the drinking. Look, he wasn't there for the opening of obviously the Kalgoorlie pipeline, because he died 14 months earlier. But nor was he there for the opening of the Fremantle Harbour.
He was in Adelaide.
He was sent. He was off in Europe.
Off in Europe. He was
ostensibly. And you know, when he returned and gave an interview at Albany, he conceded that his nerves had been shot after... It was a very stressful thing, too, building the
harbour.
Building the harbour.
Yeah.
A lot of criticism, which didn't stop once it was up, and including by Vosper. You know, Vosper said everything that this engineer shot, that this engineer knows about engineering, can be written on the back of a postage stamp. So Vosper put his two bobs worth in. But you know, there's certainly, you know, plenty of evidence that at various times O'Connor felt the heat and felt crushed by the responsibilities and by criticism.
Yeah, and it's amazing the way this man was a civil engineer of the state, of the colony, which meant that none of the money was going to corporates as outsourcing. It was going directly from the owners of to him, and he was on a salary, and that was the end of that. So hence there wasn't 12 bob in the account at the end of the day. Look, let's let Johnny McAvoy take the honours here, because I think that sometimes O'Connor must have gone to the sea and rode on that horse for a bit of tranquility and just clear up the mind. Sure. That was evidenced in the letter that he wrote just on the way out in that morning at 6 o'clock. If wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets in the sea. Johnny McAvoy.
I wish I was home again, at home in my heart again. It's been a long time since my heart talked to me. Wasting my precious days, wishing my life away. If wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets in the sea. And I wish I was young again, my song still to be sung again. The sweet tunes of my life have gone sour and off key. Writing my tired old rhymes, trying to turn back time. If wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets in the sea. If wishes were fishes, I know where I'd be, casting my net in the dark rolling sea. And if my net's empty when it comes back to shore, I'll throw it away and go fishing no more. And I wish I could care again, reach out and share again. Mend what's been broken and let it run free. The older I get, it seems, the more wishing takes the place of dreams. If wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets in the sea. Fishes, I know where I'd be, casting my net in the dark rolling sea. And if my net's empty when it comes back to shore, I'll throw it away and go fishing no more. I wish I was home again, at home in my heart again. It's been a long time since my heart talked to me. Wasting my precious days, wishing my life away. If wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets in.
Special guest, Peter Burke, Wetting Aurelia. Peter, was it in your book or Tony Evans, forgive me, about the fact that the eldest daughter had a real issue with the fact that she was born before CY was married? Did you mention that or did...
I don't think I mentioned it.
Yeah, and that, no, hence...
Again, not at all uncommon back in those days.
Yeah, but hence all of his writings, yes, of which there were lots and boxes, and she burnt everything.
Yes.
And yes. Mike Lefroy was saying that his grandmother, great-grandmother, that no matter how much you would press her to even talk about, because they wanted to find out when they were adults, and she was still alive, she wouldn't say a thing. It was a taboo subject within the family.
Yes.
And so I think, go on, over to you.
Well, I think, sadly, we would nowadays see, a family affected by suicide as being a victim of suicide.
Yep.
But, you know, it was a source of great shame to the family, and nobody would want to talk about it, and certainly not start exploring the reasons whereby it came about. I think our approach to this has changed enormously over the years, you know.
Would you talk a little bit more about that? Because I'll tell you, artistically, some people, and even in the arts world, people are afraid of the word suicide with C.Y. O'Connor. And they themselves are truly acknowledged and expressed. I'm speaking of specific people here without naming them. They're acknowledged in the art world themselves. And there was an attempt made to put stage dance a couple of years ago, representing symbolically his legacy. But the focus of the death was done very stylistically, with beautiful girls with waving blue materials woven around their bodies, and they unfolded the blue, and he kind of went underneath in the image of CY, and the Tony Jones statue or sculpture was on the sea. And yet the thinking was that one was possibly... First of all, it was a state-gifted, sponsored event, and that you know, one was possibly, you know, abusing public funds, and that was 2016 or 17. You know, people can have these. I suppose they're afraid of the mental health thing going on about such a hero and an Irishman as well. You know that they were being. I don't know. It's just. What do you think? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I can't help but, you know, once you know the family. There's a very famous portrait of the O'Connor family, which was actually taken in New Zealand before they came.
Oh, it's in the front of your book.
Yeah, before they came out.
Yeah.
And you can't help looking across those poor children and poor Susan Letitia, the wife, and think about how they would have each taken the news. There's poor Biddy, who was Bridget, later
I noticed you
later Lady Lee Steer.
You informally call her Biddy as well,
what her dad called her.
Yeah.
And they would ride every single morning.
Yeah.
Every single morning. And I'm sure it was, you know, part of the routine. I'm sure anyone who was up around the streets of Frio back in those days would say, "G'day, Chief," you know.
Yeah.
And off they went. And she was his unabashed favourite.
She and breakfast afterwards in the Devilac.
They used to go, and he was very close to the widow Manning.
But
horses, I think, was the connection there.
Yeah.
and breakfast, a good hot feed.
But, bacon and eggs.
Biddy,
and eggs.
But, you know, Biddy was sick that morning and couldn't ride. And, you know, the heartache that must have ensued from what if I wasn't sick, she was in bed. And the poor fella on the left there, Roderick, who became an engineer as well with Public Works and Rail, you know, it was his pistol that from his room.
Yes.
So his father snuck into his room and took the pistol
when he was asleep.
The whole thing. Nobody's going to want to discuss this. You know, afterwards, I don't think. Well, we would now. We'd deliberately say, but the natural inclination is just to say this is too hard to discuss, and I think that was the nature of things back then.
Yeah, that image you've just shown. I'm looking at it myself in the front of the book. It's just wonderful.
Mm.
And what was the girl who was the friend of the nurse? I just want to go back to her for a moment.
Well, she's made up. So it is one of those books where I throw in the odd character who
but there is one daughter. I mean, I know
Kate O'Connor.
Kate.
I've got a little friend called Polly Groves.
Polly Groves.
She serves a purpose which is not strictly a historical one.
No, but it's lovely the way the two of them are gossiping and chatting as beautiful young girls
Kate would be your favourite.
Absolutely.
She was feisty and never married. I think quite a cranky, you know, in later life. She never forgave Western Australia. She didn't want to come back here. She did have to come back, I think, largely because of, you know, financial reasons. But
yeah.
I'm think she was a fairly cranky old lady, and but she would have been a ripper, you know, as a young woman.
Yeah.
I think she was a very strong-minded.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can see her there in the photo with a hand on her hip thinking, is the photo done yet, you know. She's a great girl.
Yes, indeed.
And when I look at that photo, I also see the missing child. There was a Charles Jr. who died in awful circumstances. While Dad was giving a speech at, you know, a long speech at his own farewell in New Zealand, and an accident with boiling water on the pot, and you know, I think there was a lot of sadness in that in the family, actually.
Yes, so we're looking at now.
Yeah.
Okay, so right, where do we go from here? I mean, it's just an extraordinary a journey.
By way of background, just 1901 Federation. So we went from this stability of John Forrest for 10 years, everything worked.
Yep.
The West Australian, Winthrop Hackett supporting almost everything he did, and lots of money. Everything changed with Federation for this state. You know, we had 5 premiers in 1901. The opposition got in, and we all know when the opposition gets in, they can't wait to go through the old filing cabinet if they haven't sold it at a second-hand furniture sale, and find all as many bad things as they possibly can, and so, you know, Forrest was premier for January, then for February it was Throssell, who was a completely stone deaf. The Lion of Northam, they used to call him, but he was, I don't think he was premier material. And then the great oppositionist got in, and that was Leake.
Mm.
Now, you know, there's some funny photos from the time about how the corking device will make sure that it doesn't leak, and it's called Premier Leake. Okay, so there were some contemporary puns about the pipeline leak. But Leake had sat in fierce opposition to Forrest for a decade, looking across the chamber at him.
Yeah.
And he was on record as saying, I would like the whole thing smashed up. I care not what by what means. Talking about the pipeline, he would have approved it if it had been by a private enterprise. But Forrest made the decision that it was going to be a public works.
Yeah,
and so now he was in, and now he's in no particular reason for Leake to go hiding any problem. So if any problem came across his desk, his big role was to cast any problems backwards in time, back to the era of Forrest, who had now left and gone off to Melbourne to federal politics.
He
didn't last long, and a guy called Alf Morgans came in for October, and he got smashed by Tommy Walker in some fierce articles. So, you know, really in the weeks leading up to that February 1902 article, Tommy Walker had dispatched a premier, Alf Mexican Morgans, he used to call him.
Yeah.
Moloch Menace of da 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 da.
Yeah.
And he had also attacked successfully a Supreme Court judge in a complicated case, which also ended up in. But he was fearless. Priests, you know, the odd engineer wouldn't bother him.
Take them down by media.
Mm.
Okay, well, we hope to have Bernard Carney with us. He's a local singer. Do you know Bernard?
Everyone knows Bernard Carney. I think he was there in 1902, wasn't he? I mean, Bernard seems to have been.
Well, he most certainly is going to be there in 2018 at the South Jetty or the C.Y. O'Connor Beach, singing The Eyes of the Engineer. And let's hear a preview of it now. By the way, just before we go with the track, Jerry and Peter, you've agreed to come. We are making this outside broadcast open to you to join us so that we've contacted some of the people from Darkness into Light. We're hoping that what was a private gathering of the descendants of C.Y. O'Connor and chosen friends now to be open to you out there, listener. So let's remind ourselves about Bernard Carney and what his song has done for C.Y. O'Connor.
harbor. There's a statue thinking in bronze, one of the far-sighted ones with a vision clear. He's gazing at life in the harbor, the extent of his enterprise, watching the world through the eyes of the engineer. He's taking in the speed of the progress, the transport and trade there has been, ships that have colored the scene over all these years. It's all a result of his labors, though they slandered and criticized. He looked to the future through the eyes of the engineer. And the work was so hard when they blasted the bar, but the critics proved harder to move. There was so much more to be shifted on shore before things could begin to improve. We've taken the harbor for granted, but we soon came to realize the strength of the vision in the eyes of the engineer. New stories, new themes, suitcases filled up with dreams to be planted here. He's so much a part of this story, but just a statue standing serene, still surveying the scene through the eyes of the engineer. Look to the future through the eyes of the engineer.
Just a reminder that the AIHA Film Club continue to present a Festival of Irish Films, and I am so regretting not having seen Philadelphia Here I Come. I'm going to have to ask Tony Bray and Dennis Breton of the Australian Irish Heritage to allow me a loan of a copy so that I can see of Philadelphia Here I Come, which was on this Wednesday, the 14th of February. Now, it was a classic night, but next Wednesday, the season carries on in the garden of Tony and Cecilia Bray at 8 4th Avenue, Kensington. A short supporting film will precede the main film, which this week is Gold. Gold, and Gold is a comedy. Gold, an offbeat comedy about an estranged father who returns to his hometown after an absence of 10 years in order to reconnect with his daughter and ex-wife, but unwittingly finds himself responsible for almost destroying their lives, with James Nesbitt, filmed in Dublin and Wicklow and nominated for 2 IFTA awards. So please feel free to ring Tony at 9367-6026, or our president, Dennis, at 9345-3530. 9345-3530. And a note, the family is our the theme tune for the Calamunda Here I Come. Jerry Gogan, over to you, sir.
Hi, yes, this is our theme song, Ode to the Family from the Cranberries. I have to give a big shout out here for the cast of this wonderful little production in a lovely theatre in Calamunda at the Town Square. And this is directed by Caroline MacDonald and obviously written by Noel O'Neill, very well known. We have quite a few shows to go yet. We're on tonight on the 18th. And then tonight the 17th, and then Sunday the 18th, and then we've got February the 21st, 23rd, 24th, 25th, 28th, and the last final two shows are on the 2nd of March and the 3rd of March. So to book, you need to kind of get on to Try Booking, and adults are $20, concession 17, and there is a fish and chip night, which I'm wondering what that's going to turn out like, $30. Group bookings to Linda Murray on 0448 779 891 or www.trybooking.com, and you can get your tickets through that way if you like. But I have to kind of say hi to all the guys, who are a wonderful bunch of people. To Brian Donovan, who plays Billy, and to Connor O'Hara, who plays Davey, and Alton Kiley, who plays Charlie, and of course, not forgetting our wonderful Stan O'Neill, who plays Granda, and Emer Baylor, who plays my lovely daughter, Lulu. And then we have a lovely, my youngest young boy, Nathan Holland, who plays Mikey, and Mammy and myself, Denise Byrne playing Mammy, and myself as Debbie. And I'm not forgetting John Sperling, our technician, and everything's been, and all, of course, the committee of CADS. A big shout out to everybody, and please book and come along. It's a wonderful night, and you really enjoy it. Thanks.
And I must say, last night, yes, I did manage to get to Charolais by Noni Stapleton, and it is an incredible performance. I mean, this woman has an affair with her boyfriend, and she's going to be pregnant. She is pregnant, largely pregnant, but so is the Charolais cow. And she vies with the Charolais cow for the affections that she sees her boyfriend having with the cow. And Noni manages to go if this and if that as the love woman looking for the love of her partner, but she kind of does the Charolais cow by going into a French accent and doing a very sort of a with her bum swinging from left to right, and she pulls down the hair and becomes a very appealing, sensuous, sexual kind of cow looking for her own needs, and talks about how painful it is to have, having IVF in the animal world, and not enjoying the experience. It's a hugely popular, and I know of no doubt that Noni Stapleton will go on to perform in Bunbury and from there on into Adelaide. But it was a one-woman show organised as part of the festival Fringe, and it was well worth going. Ending our little chats before we return to the wonderful chat with Peter, the St. Patrick's Day Mass is confirmed now. I just wanted to reassure you. Organised by the Irish community of WA, and I'm still trying to work out who they are, in spite of working intensely with the cathedral, answering all the calls. My home number was given to certain peoples. They're welcome to come on air anytime, including Paul Tenham, to speak about the fact that this Mass is going ahead at St. Mary's Cathedral, Perth, Victoria Square, on St. Patrick's Day on the 17th of March. Now, also in place is an amazing, and we're ending here, the Arthur Kennedy lecture is the Mary Durack lecture happening in the forthcoming Irish scene. You're going to see details of that, because Dennis Bratton, our chairman, has succeeded in getting Peter Connolly. You will know Peter's articles from the Irish scene. And beginning, Peter was amazing in the fact that he came, or no, spent a time in Western Australia. Arthur Kennedy felt things deeply. He sold his army commission in 1847 and went to work for the Poor Law Commission. He was placed in the town of Kilrush, Grogonstown, County Clare, as a poor law inspector in November. Kennedy found, to his horror, that the main task was to provide relief for about half 82,000 people in the district. The current edition states, because he's now in, it mirrors, in fact, what Peter is saying about people going to high places. He then goes and becomes in Northern Territory, and he's in WA, or should I say, he's in the colony. And see, he encouraged exploration and surveying work, and a handling of interesting expeditions were launched under his auspices. His appeals for existence from the imperial authorities in London were bluntly rejected in July 1860, and the potential of the fledging industry was never fully realized. All of that and more you will hear in the forthcoming Mary Durack lecture, and we are really glad that that's penciled in, and you will see notification of that in the Irish Scene coming up, and of course our websites in the AIHA. What's amazing me, Peter, is that when people are talking about both John Boyle O'Reilly and C.Y. O'Connor, is that it isn't very long after the same famine that these two men were born. You know?
True, I mean.
You know, if you just take in the significance of this, maybe you haven't gone into it much, but it always occurs to me, that people like that, born around those years, must have first a remnant of Gaelic in them, and secondly, a race of people doesn't get over the trauma of a famine in one generation, in fact, never.
Mm. Yes, I mean, we had a great variety of folk from different circumstances come to Australia, obviously because of the Great Famine. In O'Connor's case, you know, his family were landowners, around at Gravel Mount in County Meath, and so, you know, in his situation, I guess if there hadn't been that awful situation, he would have stayed and been lord of the manor and collected rent and in a way. Straitened circumstances are a great motivator for an individual. He had to go and do something to earn a living, and it's to the eternal gratitude of New Zealand and Western Australia that he had to.
Yeah, and so he was very early on in life. What was the word where he was working in rails already in Ireland? There's a word for his title. Not engineering as much as... I remember I had just on the tip of my tongue interviewing Mike Lefroy. Anyway, what I'm saying is his passion and vision for civil engineering was evident from the very beginning, and the vision was just extraordinary. How severe was, not the cool guardy of the pipeline now, but in that thing of Fremantle would never be what it is now, were it not for him then. Go back on the sandblasting and the fact that the explosives were introduced by him as an idea of getting rid of the sandbar and looking at the fact that it could be a deep sea port. Did you write extensively about that in the book?
Well, no. Where I take the story up, that sort of happened. The port is already there, but that was his first big decision.
Yep.
When he arrived in this colony, John Forrest had already made the decision that the port would be an open water port.
Yep.
He'd been advised by the Empire's preeminent harbour designer that you'd have an ongoing problem with silting up of the of if you tried to build it in the river mouth. So that was an early example of O'Connor putting his metaphoricals on the line there.
That's right. Yeah,
and he worried about it. He was a worrier, and you know, it wasn't an unmitigated success. You know, after it was built, there was a bit of structural stuff that needed fixing up, and occasionally I wonder, you know, if when he was down on that beach looking out, which happens to be where the port would have been, you know, at his final resting place, if you like. He would have been looking out at sea at where, you know, where the port would have been if he'd followed the line. So he had to make that early decision. But obviously, Fremantle itself would be a very different town without the port. It's unimaginable to us, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm. And where the C.Y. O'Connor Beach is now, renamed, was there a jetty jutting out there instead of a groin, which is there's the groin to the left, groin to the right now?
Yes, it was mostly, I mean, Rob's jetty was you know, very much at the service of one of O'Connor's not admirers, which was Alexander Forrest, who was making a lot of money from the Kimberley, where he was the sole land agent, and he was interested in facilitating the cattle industry in particular. And they had a bit of a sulk and didn't want to use Fremantle Harbour. And so Rob's jetty and the abattoir that was there was very closely associated with Alexander Forrest. He would have been surrounded by his structures. You know, as he stood on that beach, he could see across to Rottnest and see his lighthouse. And,
that's right.
And see back to Fremantle.
That's
Harbour.
CY's, lighthouse, which he rebuilt and reinforced. But where the cattle linings are all down on either side, the fencing going down, that's where the cattle actually did go on board, which on the jetty and onto the boat. Would I be right in saying that?
Sometimes they'd force them to. Be forced to swim ashore, actually. I have a stray one just hanging around lonely in my version of events there, just as a sort of a symbolic.
A reminder, symbolic. Yeah, there's a lovely symbolic railing down the way down to the jetty now with all of the, What do you seriously think of the piece of sculpture in the sea?
I love it. I think that same, who's the sculptor again?
Tony Jones. Thank you, Jerry.
So, and he's also responsible for Matilda, I think.
And
they are two iconic, understated, serve the purpose absolutely brilliantly. And on the morning on the 10th of March, if it's the usual ceremony, the family just going out there, rose petals and the physical contact with
and bougainvillea,
the physical contact with that
with the statue
is wonderful. I might read one paragraph, which is just I mean, I don't, you'd hate to think everyone's going to stand there and think of the final bit. He loved that place. He and Biddy, that was his favourite place in Western Australia. Was that stretch of beach? Obviously, the final day was horrible. But I've got an earlier bit in the chapter that you started off talking about, whose name I've now forgotten, is Arthur Lynch was his groom.
Yes.
And Arthur's riding with Biddy.
Oh, that's a beautiful part, yeah.
Yeah, riding with Biddy, his favourite daughter.
And you're writing of Arthur Lynch, the way he's watching from the window that the master is ready and getting up, is just brilliant. Yeah. I love it.
Thank you. So the three continued on horseback, heading south, down Beach Street, over land reclaimed from the sea, through the wakening town of Fremantle, and down Pakenham with all its impressive new buildings under construction, all paid for by gold and shipping. On the outskirts they passed through the growing sprawl of canvased dwellings, with smoky campfires and the wandering urchins of the recent arrivals, and then headed south along the limestone coast following the tracks, through the scrubby bush, past the pungent lead smelter, and the limestone quarry and the explosives factory. An engineer's route, this, not a pretty one. And down the dune to the rather ugly grey sand beach where, unprompted, the O'Connor's horses broke into their daily gallop. This beach was a sacred place to Mr. O'Connor and Biddy. This morning it was theirs alone. Father and daughter teased each other as they raced. The chief seemed in rare good form today, and Arthur felt the air he breathed was sweeter for the O'Connors having passed through it.
The Healy's, C.Y. O'Connor.
See a statue of a man riding a horse in the surf beside Fremantle Beach. He devoted his life to supply water to the dry and desert gold fields, criticize and call the crocodile imposter. He was an Irish engineer from County Meath. His name was C.Y. O'Connor. As I look at the waves beat his statue, I see a man looking after the people of his nation. That burning dry desert of Western Australia.
to the surf, he held a gun. He shot himself. Finally flowed less than a year from his death. I hope the carpers felt ashamed. O'Connor, may you rest in peace. His name was C.Y. O'Connor. As I look at the waves beat his statue, I see a man looking after the people of his nation. That burning dry desert of Western Australia. We can learn from C.Y. O'Connor. As we look at the waves beat his statue, we see a man looking after an exploding population. In the barren dry desert, Western Australia, that burning dry desert of Western Australia, Western Australia.
Beer Kjol, August Crack. Good time, great music, great food, and great crack at Friar Tuck's Irish House in Mandra. Open 7 days every day. So for a total Irish experience and something different, it's gotta be Friar Tuck's Irish House. Telephone 953-447-88, www.friartucks.com.au. Friar Tuck's, station sponsor.
Hello, I'm Jerry Gannon, and for over 30 years I've searched Australia for a decent black pudding. And finally, I found it, right here in Perth. Artisan Gourmet's traditional Irish black pudding is made using a recipe that comes from my native Galway. It's the best I've ever tasted, and it's now available together with white pudding and the full range of meat products at Artisan Gourmet, Shop 3, 51 Belvedere Street, Belmont. Drop in and see Butcher Steve Sellers or order online at artisangourmet.com.au or call 9277 1056. Irish Black Pudding from station sponsor Artisan Gourmet. Toshe Gohana Holin.
And just quoting Peter Berg for a moment, I was just driving to work this into RRTR-FM and heard this beautiful songs of Sounds of the Pilbara too. Pinakajari by Greg Gardner. I didn't understand the lyrics, of course, but it brought a tear to my eye. Beautiful, sad song. I contacted Georgia from WEM, who was responsible for this interview this morning, by the way, to buy a bunch of presents and found out more about the project. That sort of song would never have made it in Perth ears without a project like this. Everyone wins, the local musos, the community they live in, for all sorts of reasons, and the lucky of us who are gifted, and the lucky us who are gifted the end product. Commerce will never deliver such gifts. It will deliver One Direction. Now, Peter, where is the book available? Because I got mine in Fremantle, but where else is it available?
Well, it's a pretty Fremantle book there, so the Chart and Map Shop in Collie Street. Chart and Map Shop, you can physically go pick it up there. Or they've got a really good online ordering system. Just put Chart and Map Shop there. Good family-owned business, and they've been a very good supporter of the book there. It's also in Applecross at the Well and at the Lane in Claremont. But if you're a Freo person, you could do worse than... I think New Edition would have a few copies.
That's where I got this.
See Danny at the Chart and Map Shop in Collie Street there.
See Danny, Chart and... Fine. All right. Something I wanted to say was that I loved your linking into the Aboriginal factor, which is huge in your book, really. I love the way you welcomed the country at the very beginning. So it is only right before we commence a story set at the time of Federation that we recall that the history of this land predates 1901 by a quantity of time which we might as well call forever. We should respectfully acknowledge the past and present traditional owners of the land in which this story is set, the western third of this enormous island continent, and bear in mind that it had been occupied, lived in, fished in, hunted upon, walked over, fought over, and so on for many countless generations before we Europeans happened to come along for keeps. Oh, beautiful piece.
Well, it's true, and I think one of my themes too is the connection between immigrant Irish and the local indigenous population.
That's very interesting.
I've sort of thought about that out loud, but it has occurred to me there is a real simpatico there. I think the sense of humour.
Yeah.
I've done a fair bit of Northwest medicine, and yeah, the Irish sense of humour and the Aboriginal sense of humour, I often find identical. It's very curious, and there may be a sort of a link there. So I sort of have Paddy Hannon thinking out loud in my chapter, my stream of consciousness thing about Paddy Hannon. And I don't know what Paddy thought, but I thought he might have thought something like this. I've got him speaking to Kerwin, who was a journalist there, and he did an interview with Kerwin, who couldn't get a peep out of him. But I've got him saying this: gold is a curse as much as a blessing. I've led the British bankers and speculators here to this secret place, like some sort of national traitor in the old stories. And then a wolf whistle from the likes of Brookman and Morgan's, and the trickle turns to a flood. Not one of these big mines about us is owned by an Australian. The British own them all, and they will not leave Kerwin, not while there's $6 million a year to be made, just as they will not leave Ireland, and they will not leave South Africa, despite the very strong encouragement they have had to do so. This catastrophe, like the others, will be permanent. These poor folk have been delivered into the grabbing hands of the British, of whom we Irish have a saying, confiscation is their common title. I feel guilty for it, Kerwin, for this is all my doing, and I've seen this before, and I know well enough how it will end. He'd been asked in this thing, and this is actually true, he'd been asked to find the original site where they could put a little monument, and a little privet hedge was put there. So he adds, the mayor told me once the water comes there'll be a reticulation, and then a lawn and a privet hedge will be planted in front of that pepper tree which now marks the spot. Tell the mayor for me, Kerwin, that Mr. Hannon has requested that the hedge be fashioned into the words, sorry for all this.
Wow. Wow, that's the Paddy Hannon we don't know about, and that's not stereotypical. Mm. There's a whole 2 hours in you, you know, Peter? And in fact, more, because we haven't spoken about the fact that you are a travel doctor, yeah?
I'm a GP with a number of interests, but I've got particular interest in the health of travellers and vaccinating travellers and returned folk with interesting tropical illnesses.
Okay. Look, I'm going to mention again, how can I not, the fact that Wetting Aurelia is Peter's brilliant work. I know you've enticed as much as I have about it. And we didn't go through the cliched, sad journey. It was more a celebration of C.Y. O'Connor and a very sharp, a keen look at his detractors. To Jerry Grogan, my producer, to all the cast of Kalamunda Here I Come, chukas to all of you, and my lovely friend Caroline MacDonald, and all of yous. I know we'll be there next week. Peter, it's been really enjoyable. Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Frank, and thanks for the interest. You know, it's a very Fremantle story, and it couldn't be a better place to discuss it.
Oh, it's not the beginning. It's not the end. It's the beginning. We're going to open the floodgates even more and let the water gush in another time.
A very nice watery analogy there.
Yeah, thank you. Fiona Mariah is saying her farewells this morning. Welcome back, Fiona. Time to say goodbye, I think, is coming up by Jerry's choice, and indeed it is time to say goodbye. Thank you, Jerry Grogan, for producing and looking kicking. Care of us both this morning. Good evening, Chuckling, Shahoin, Oimsha, Kahamid Gwelig, Hadishah, and Shin, Frank Murphy, and Shah. Take care, as long as you.
quando se lontana sogno all'orizzonte io mancan le parole e io sì lo so che sei con me tu mia luna tu sei qui con